This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Grey History. Before we get into it, here's a quick message from Robin at the History of Byzantium podcast explaining the amazing work he's doing over there. The History of Byzantium is one of my personal favorite history podcasts, so if you're looking for the history of the Eastern Roman Empire, I recommend you check it out.
Hello, everyone. This is Robin Pearson from the History of Byzantium podcast. If you're someone who likes a bit of Roman history but thinks it ends in 476 AD, then do I have good news for you. It hasn't even begun. To check out 1,000 years of fascinating history and exciting stories, check out the History of Byzantium wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, it's back to the French Revolution.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Grey History. Episode 68, Marseille, Fight and Flight. In the last episodes, we discussed the Grand Insurrection of Lyon, a revolt brutally crushed in one of the most iconic and controversial acts of the Revolution's terror. But if mass executions awaited a city which did at least attempt to parley with the convention, what about a city that refused? What about a great urban centre that actually forcefully occupied nearby towns, that refused to adopt the constitution, and even attempted to collaborate with the British? Well, welcome to the madness of Marseille, another great city with another great story. But before we get into it, a tremendous, enormous, humongous thank you to the people keeping this show on the air. Thank you to everyone in the Grey History community contributing a small amount each episode, as it's only with your help that I can keep bringing you the show you've come to love. A reminder that episode 67, Lyon, The Blame Game, is a fantastic bonus episode available just for members of the community. To enjoy this and other exclusive content, along with an ad-free feed, early access, and the warm fuzzy feelings that come with supporting one of your favourite independent podcasters, please support the show today through the links in the show notes or on the website. Help make history that isn't black and white, and help keep this revolution alive. A warm welcome to the newest members of the Grey History community. This includes the newest virtuous citizens, James, Jonathan, Earl, Haley, Eleanor, Mira, Chris, Michael, Seb, Kenneth, John, Lachlan, Laura, Christine, Louis, and Jody. Another warm welcome to the newest True Revolutionaries, Muriel, Tobias, Tim, and an anonymous True Revolutionary from North Carolina. Also joining them is both Torek and Andrew, who recently increased their pledge. I hope you all enjoyed early access to this episode weeks ahead of the main show. Of course, all revolutions need their champions, so a special shout out to the champions of the people, Cindy, George, Mark, William, Laura, Daniel, Monica, Joel, Adam, Tom, Eyal, Harold, David, Alistair, Kevin, Carl, Jeff, Retus, and Hannah. Lastly, one final thank you to the amazingly generous Heroes of the Revolution, Brian, Charles, Jeff, Auger, Kevin, Scott, and Howard. Finally, it alarms me to inform you that there has been some counter-revolutionary activity of late. I suppose it's a mark of the show's growing popularity, but unfortunately, after 5 years, some reactionary fun sponges have recently left Grey History its first 1- and 2-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. Now, usually, I would ignore such unenlightened behaviour and consider it an inevitable achievement of all noteworthy podcasts. But these reviews are impacting the recommendation algorithms, and therefore, they're literally impacting the discoverability of the show for new listeners. Consequently, they're also jeopardizing me being able to bring you Grey History, as this experiment in full-time production is still very much an experiment. So if you listen to Grey History on Apple Podcasts, and you haven't done so previously, if you could please leave a written review, that would be absolutely amazing. Just go to Grey History in the app and scroll down to the review section and help me expunge this counter-revolutionary plot. Anyway, that's enough from me. So thank you to everybody supporting Grey History in some way, shape, or form, and let's get into it. Humans are creatures of contradictions. Whether it be our habits, our values, or just how we interpret the world around us, our entire way of living is rife with inconsistencies. The same is true for groups of humans, be it our cultures, our ideologies, our communities. Contradictions are plentiful. In this, revolutionary Marseille was no different. In some ways, the Marseille of the French Revolution was a citadel of revolutionary passion. It had been volunteer fédérés from Marseille which had led the toppling of the monarchy, and it was Marseille which lent its name to the French national anthem, still called La Marseillaise today. For years, the list of patriotic deeds was both so extensive and so consequential that the great Mediterranean port could rival Paris for the title of the nation's most revolutionary city. And yet, despite this impeccable record and reputation, Marseille was also a city of rebellion. A leading member of the Federalist revolts, Marseille was denounced by some deputies as the original and primordial cause of nearly all of the nation's ills. So, it's in this contradiction that we find the question. How is it that a city and a people known for their revolutionary enthusiasm could be portrayed as the source of nearly all of the country's troubles? How is it that the shepherds of the Republic were also the harbingers of treason? To kick us off, it's always worth starting with an introduction. Originally founded by Greek colonists in roughly 600 BCE, Marseille is the oldest city in France. Located both on the Mediterranean coast and near the mouth of the Rhône River, Marseille was a natural candidate for a bustling commercial centre. Granted various privileges by French monarchs, the port flourished as it traded with both France and the wider Mediterranean world. Reflective of this prosperity was a population boom. By the time of the Bastille's fall, Marseille's population was somewhere around 100 to 110,000, making it roughly on par with Bordeaux. Together with Paris and Lyon, these four cities were the only urban centres with more than 100,000 inhabitants. Supporting this sizeable population was trade, the lifeblood of Marseille's economy. In particular, the city specialised in trade with the Eastern Mediterranean. Marseille also had a reasonable role in the importation of food, which would then be sold across southern France. Not dependent on the silk industry like Lyon, the absence of one domineering luxury resulted in significant deviations from the nation's second city. While pre-revolutionary Lyon was governed by a small and exclusive aristocratic elite, the aristocracy in Marseille were comparatively less influential and more open. Indeed, down south, the wealthy merchants ruled the roost, be they recently ennobled families or just the upper echelons of the mercantile bourgeoisie. Now, this was still a small group compared to the population as a whole, but it was larger and more open than the governing clique of Lyon. Historian Michael Kennedy notes that in Marseille, very little distinguished the aristocracy from the wealthy merchants, and that the two groups were united by both marriage and mutual interest. Indeed, if one studies the list of grievances in the lead-up to the Estates General, one sees that the two cohorts had considerable similarities in priorities and perspectives. But Marseille wasn't just different from Lyon, it was different from Paris and the broader nation. The great Mediterranean port is more than 400 miles, or nearly 700 kilometres, south of the capital, resulting in at least a 4 to 5 day delay for news from Paris. This remoteness fostered a reasonable level of autonomy from Versailles, especially when combined with historical and linguistic factors. The ancient city claimed ancient privileges, and a thick local accent had traditionally made communication with northerners extremely difficult. Combined with Versailles' mockery of the uncultured southerners, a whole range of factors promoted a proud, unique, and independent identity for the city's inhabitants. Be that as it may, it was with great enthusiasm that Marseille embraced the French Revolution in 1789. Royal symbols of despotism were promptly targeted, and a new municipal government and militia were embraced with glee. Almost reenacting the storming of the Bastille in Paris, the city's inhabitants even stormed two sizable forts, both of which were largely demolished in the weeks that followed. As the revolution wore on, Marseille's budding reputation as a revolutionary citadel continued to grow. The local Jacobin club was embraced by many in the merchant community, and the club took on a crusading persona as it sought to spread the revolution's values. And to be clear, there was preaching to be done. In the early years of the revolution, the south of France was a hotbed for both real and imagined counter-revolutionary activities. We've already heard how Lyon was quickly perceived to be a bastion of reactionary royalism, and disturbances were common throughout the wider region, including in the papal enclave of Avignon. As such, the Jacobins of Marseille were keen to do their part. Historian Paul Hansen notes that repeated forays were conducted to neighbouring towns and villages, resulting in Jacobin missionaries propagating revolutionary ideals. Sometimes these revolutionaries relied on the force of persuasion, and other times through the force of, well, just force. So common were these ventures that evidence exists of Marseille's merchants grumbling at the frequent absence of their workers. But if Marseille was rivaling Paris for the title of most revolutionary city, the jewel in the crown, or perhaps the cockade in the cap, was the overthrow of the monarchy. In mid-1792, Charles Barbaroux, a deputy in the Legislative Assembly, had called for support from his constituents in Marseille. Asking for 600 men who knew how to die, the result was the volunteer Federays, who played a crucial role in the storming of the Tuileries Palace on the 10th of August 1792. With the Federays from Marseille and Brest leading the toppling of the monarchy, the Mediterranean city had secured a near unassailable reputation for revolutionary enthusiasm and, indeed, republicanism. Nothing could be more different to the city of Lyon. Yet, this is the French Revolution, which means I'm about to talk about how everything went wrong. Despite Marseille's embrace of both the revolution and then the republic, the city proceeded to tear itself apart as 1793 wore on. Like Lyon, a struggle emerged between leading revolutionaries, with factions forming around the Montagnard-aligned Jacobins and a broad anti-Jacobin alliance primarily backed by Republicans sympathetic to the Girondins. To back up a bit, the local Jacobin club of Marseille was no stranger to divisions by the time 1792 came to an end. Many in the club had tried to straddle the emerging gulf between the Girondins and the mountain in the capital. Declaring themselves to be neither Rollonan nor Morarist, the club nonetheless vocally supported two prominent revolutionaries on either side of the Jacobin divide. From the mountain, Robespierre naturally held much respect amongst the local clubbists. From the Gironde, it was Barbaroux, the deputy who had summoned the Marseille Federates to topple the monarchy, and who himself was a deputy representing the city of Marseille. But in mid-December, the Jacobin Club of Paris formally denounced Barbaroux, and by the end of the month, his policy positions proved irreconcilable with Marseille's local society. A close associate of the then Interior Minister Rollon, Barbaroux had been an early critic of Robespierre in the first months of the convention. Perhaps more importantly, he was also an early advocate for the appeal to the people, the nationwide referendum which was proposed to determine the king's fate. Anything but the guillotine was deeply unpopular in staunchly republican Marseille, and pro-Montagnard elements of the local club used Barbaroux's position to denounce both him and his supporters back home. Demanding death to the tyrant and warning of the dangers of federalism, the Montagnard wing of Marseille's Jacobin society soon became dominant. With their position on the appeal to the people used to discredit the Girondins, Barbaroux was formally expelled from the local Jacobin club by the end of January 1793. Coinciding with the radicalization of the Marseille Jacobin club was the triumph of the Montagnard wing of the local society in municipal elections. In January 1793, Jacobin candidates gained control of Marseille's municipal council, fundamentally altering the politics of the city. Just as the victory of Lyon's Jacobins upset the apple cart, so too did similar developments in Marseille. In fact, over the next few months, the developments of Lyon and Marseille look extremely similar. Working hand in hand, the city's Jacobin club and the Jacobin municipality proceeded to implement a wide-ranging Jacobin agenda. In particular, the new local regime had a hyper-focus on counter-revolutionary threats. Aggressive measures were taken to denounce, disarm, and detain all possible suspects. Furthermore, a revolutionary tribunal was established to judge the accused. With a list of suspects numbering in the hundreds, these measures provoked alarm and dismay, at least amongst those cohorts fearful of Jacobin radicalism. Now, these rather severe measures are indeed similar to the approach taken by Lyon's Jacobins, but these policies were just the start of the similarities. Be they the representatives on mission, the municipality's failings, or the response of their opponents, for a few short months, Marseille more or less mimicked its larger neighbor to the north.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
If we start with the representatives on mission, several deputies arrived in Marseille in late March 1793. You may recall that the representatives on mission were often Jacobin-aligned deputies, and here we find no deviation from the norm. Eager to assist their ideological allies, the new arrivals provided a considerable boost to the local Jacobin agenda. This not only included support for the arrest of suspects and the dismissal of untrustworthy officials, but also the recruitment of a new force of 6,000 men. Officially, this battalion was to be used to suppress counter-revolutionary stirrings in nearby departments, but detractors saw something far more sinister. Like the anti-Jacobin coalition of Lyon, Marseille's moderates saw the new force as a possible tool for Jacobin tyranny. After all, the local Montagnards were disarming citizens and drawing up lists of suspects which numbered in the hundreds. From their perspective, this new battalion amounted to a private Jacobin army, one that could be used to forcefully implement unjust and tyrannical policies. Of course, while the precise nature of the policy program was a matter of perspective, what is of less contention is its radical nature. While not as extreme as Lyon's Jacobins under Joseph Chalais, Marseille's Jacobins were nonetheless radical. Rhetoric against the rich was common, as were calls for forced loans and other illiberal economic measures. Furthermore, with news of the capital's increasing factionalism and of the coalition's successful counterattack in Belgium and the Rhineland, the local authorities ratcheted up the rhetoric. Vocal calls were heard for another revolution, and demands were made that the nation only recognise the convention's Montagnard deputies. In fact, historian Michael Kennedy claims that there was even talk of placing a bounty of 10,000 livres on any deputy, dead or alive, who had supported the appeal to the people. Unsurprisingly, such rhetoric and such policies were unwelcome with a considerable cohort of the city's inhabitants. Like Lyon, many individuals sympathetic to the revolution, including former Jacobins, started to coalesce into a united opposition. As was occurring near simultaneously up the Rhône River, a broad anti-Jacobin coalition was forming, consisting of sincere Republicans, secret monarchists, and the politically apathetic that had been roused into action through fear or hunger. As historian William Scott puts it, "What is beyond question is that the clubbists demanded measures which were far too ruthless and wide-ranging to win the wholehearted approval of those who had controlled the destinies of the city, that they provoked these people to a reaction against Jacobinism with its very real threat of terror, and forced people who had hitherto been indifferent to the political struggle to enter political activity and to enter on the side of the enemies of the Jacobins." Interestingly, the composition of the emerging anti-Jacobin coalition and their methods of resistance continued Marseille's trend of mirroring developments upriver. While Marseille lacked Lyon's tradition of neighbourhood political societies, the city naturally had sections. Prior to 1792, the sections behaved primarily as electoral organs, which, to be fair, was their primary purpose. But after the overthrow of the monarchy, Marseille's sections started to act as more permanent and expansive political institutions, just as the Parisian sections had been doing for some time. The transformation from electoral organ to deliberative body was partially fueled by elections for the convention, along with the formation of the Republic. The process was also driven by the fears and necessities of wartime, particularly with the Prussian invasion of France in the summer of 1792, and later the entry of the English into the Revolutionary War in early 1793. The sections offered the perfect platform for the Jacobin opponents. As we saw in Lyon, the anti-Jacobins used the legitimacy of the sections to challenge the policies of the Jacobin Club, the Jacobin Municipality, and the Jacobin Representatives on Mission. Both sides laid claim to the more legitimate expression of popular sovereignty, and while they did so, they engaged in a variety of legal and rhetorical battles. Now, in this similarity to Lyon, it's worth noting just how different Marseille was to the capital. Like Lyon, we once again have a situation where moderates used the sections to challenge the established Jacobin authorities. In the capital, we're used to seeing the sections being the domain of the radicals, but here again, we see the traditional script of Paris turned on its head. Once more, we see evidence that the sections were perhaps a natural vehicle to challenge any administration, rather than a natural home for revolutionary radicalism. The latter might be one's interpretation if you were to observe Paris in isolation, but clearly in the other cities of France, the sections were at times the home of moderates, not militants. Yet, while early 1793 looks pretty similar in both Lyon and Marseille, there is one considerable difference. Like Lyon, Marseille will go on to conduct a municipal revolution. However, this one will be almost bloodless. Unlike Lyon, which experienced a short but violent insurrection in late May, the overthrow of Marseille's Jacobins was a rather orderly affair. Tensions in the great Mediterranean port ramped up in April 1793. By the middle of the month, many of Marseille's elites were either considered counter-revolutionary suspects, or, more importantly, fearful that they might become so. In conjunction with food shortages, economic hardships, and unpopular policies, the ranks of the municipality's detractors were swelling. With the city's sections becoming the domain of a wide coalition of anti-Jacobins, the sections started to take concrete measures to mitigate the threat of a Jacobin crackdown. Yet, it wasn't even events in Marseille that actually triggered the municipal revolution. The beautiful town of Aix-en-Provence is located just north of Marseille. Earlier that year, some local Jacobins had been implicated in a favourite revolutionary pastime: prison massacres. Okay, perhaps massacres is too strong a word, but several prisoners had been murdered, and a few months later, the sections of Aix-en-Provence ordered the arrests of leading Jacobins who had been implicated in the killings. However, the nearby representatives on mission stationed in Marseille said no. Directly intervening in the town's affairs, they ordered the closure of the sections instead. This intervention had unintended consequences. Already angered by the policies of the local and national Montagnards, the anti-Jacobins of Marseille interpreted this action as heralding an immediate and brutal repression. After all, the Jacobins had been raising a battalion of 6,000 men. They had been disarming their political opponents. They had been pursuing a range of controversial policies which detractors saw as promoting disorder, tyranny, and Jacobin plots. Given the events in Aix-en-Provence, surely the sections of Marseille were the next to be suppressed. Consequently, the sections of Marseille began to stir. Denouncing the disregard of the sovereignty of the people in Aix-en-Provence, trouble was clearly on the horizon. But as tensions escalated, Marseille's representatives on mission found themselves with one major deficiency: firepower. Unlike their peers stationed in Lyon, the deputies weren't supported by the nearby Army of the Alps. Without armed force, the representatives decided that the safest course of action was to run. A week after intervening in Aix-en-Provence, the convention's deputies fled. Once safely stationed outside the city, they attempted to reassert control from afar, which went about as well as you would expect. Specifically, the representatives declared the sections of Marseille counter-revolutionary and compromised by the rich. As such, they tried to suppress key institutions of the sections, including a central committee which had been created to coordinate their actions. Denouncing their opponents for calling themselves sovereign and for acting as if national sovereignty belonged to them, the representatives even accused the sections of Marseille of a tendency towards federalism. But despite dropping the F-bomb, the sections of Marseille were having none of it. In fact, these accusations merely inflamed the situation. Proclaiming themselves to be in a state of resistance to oppression, the sections moved fast to fill the unexpected power vacuum from the representatives' absence. A new general committee was created to coordinate the anti-Jacobin efforts, formed by delegates from each of the city's sections. Now, we've seen a similar section-based committee play leading roles before. For example, a centralised committee of the capital sections were critical in both the overthrow of the monarchy and the purge of the Girondins. Likewise, a subset of Lyon's sections joined together to lead their own municipal revolution. A similar body of Marseille's sections also turfed out the local Jacobins, but critically, this general committee will go on to be the key player in the upcoming Federalist revolts. So, with the representatives on mission fleeing Marseille in late April, and failing to suppress the section's independence in early May, the new General Committee responded with its own measures. Throughout May, the General Committee significantly curtailed the autonomy and authority of the Jacobin Club, and ordered the arrest of almost 24 prominent members. Judicial allies of the sections also tried 2 notable Jacobins who had previously been detained, resulting in the execution of the radical Savon brothers. Between the arrests, the executions, and the eventual dissolution of the Jacobin municipality, the message was clear. Jacobins were not welcome. Thus, throughout May 1793, Marseille managed to conduct a gradual and unspectacular municipal revolution, avoiding the bloody insurrection of their Lyon counterparts. By the end of the month, the city sections, through their new general committee, were in control of Marseille. But now in charge, the anti-Jacobins found themselves with a problem that we've become quite familiar with. How were they going to break the news to Paris? Deciding that everyone liked a delegation, a group of envoys were dispatched to the National Convention in the second half of May. Like the delegations we've already witnessed from both Caen and Lyon, Marseille's delegates didn't have the best of timing. However, unlike those other instances, this time Marseille's delegation arrived in Paris before the purging of the Girondins. After all, Marseille's municipal revolution occurred throughout May, and the Girondins weren't purged until the 2nd of June. Consequently, when the delegates arrived on the 23rd of May, they found the capital to be a tinderbox, but it wasn't yet in open tumult. The next day, the Commission of 12 arrested Hébert and other leading radicals, lighting the week-long fuse to the Girondins' proscription. Yet, while Marseille's delegation did get to appear before the convention, the reception was less than welcoming. In particular, the public galleries booed, hissed, and jeered as the pro-Montagnard crowd scorned the unwelcome news from the south. With the National Convention distracted by the machinations that resulted in the Girondins' downfall, the delegation achieved a grand total of nothing. But that didn't really matter, as events elsewhere soon changed the rules of the game. In fact, they changed the game entirely. Lyon overthrew its Jacobins in the final days of May, while Paris detained leading Girondin deputies on the 2nd of June. Marseille's General Commission soon had to respond to these drastic events, rather than just its own feuds with the local Montagnards. Given the sequence of events, it was actually events from Lyon which dominated deliberations in the first days of June back in Marseille. With Lyon violently overthrowing its Jacobin municipality at the end of May, Marseille became alarmed that a similar bloody struggle could also erupt at home. As such, the local Jacobin club was officially closed on the 3rd of June. Encouraged by the news that the nation's second city had more or less replicated its expulsion of Jacobin influence, Marseille was alarmed, but by no means panicked, by subsequent news from the capital. Yes, Marat and his vile anarchists had conquered Paris. Yes, Girondin deputies, including Marseille's own Charles Barbaroux, had been targeted by the Assassins of Liberty. But disorder in the capital? Well, that was Marseille's speciality. Marseille had already changed the course of the revolution once, when its fédérés toppled the monarchy in August 1792. Why could the proud Republicans of Marseille not save the nation a second time? If monarchs could be toppled, so too could Marat. Accepting the purge of the Girondins was never a possibility. Not only had the people's sovereignty been attacked, but any recognition of the Montagnard Convention would have reversed the municipal revolution of the month prior. Like the anti-Jacobins of Lyon, Marseille's new authorities were opposed to reinstating the local Jacobin club, the local Jacobin municipality, and the national Jacobin representatives on mission. This would be demanded by the convention, and this was a price that Marseille was unwilling to pay. By the 12th of June, just 10 days after the purge of the Girondins, Marseille's General Committee went on the attack. Effectively declaring the city in a state of insurrection, the General Committee implored the nation to rebel. To arms, Frenchmen, to arms! The national representation is violated. Your deputies are in irons. 40,000 bayonets besiege the convention. The sword hangs over the heads of all the defenders of the people. The threatening cries of the agitators has reduced them to silence. Finally, Marat triumphs. The crime wearing the oak leaves of the civic crown, with its retinue of torches and daggers, bustles around the remains of the broken throne which it tries to restore. Already supported by the anarchy, still warm with the blood it spilled, despotism is preparing to ascend, by naming the victims who are to form its steps. Frenchmen, can you hear the cry from the spirit of the homeland? To arms! Save the Republic! The now insurrectionists made their position clear. An ambitious and criminal municipality has attacked the national sovereignty. A disorganizing faction, after having broken all social ties, violated all the pacts that nations have made between themselves, after having covered France with ashes, with blood, and with tears, dares to prepare irons for her, irons forged by a few scoundrels in the infamous den of the Jacobins. Frenchmen, will your generous hands be chained? Will crime triumph over virtue, audacity and intrigue over justice and liberty? Will 20 million men receive their laws from the factious few? No, Marseille will defeat them. Marseille is in motion. The same thunderbolts that brought down the throne will thunder again in that city that is today guilty. Rally around their first trophies. The victors of August 10 will combat and overturn anarchy on those same fields that witnessed their first triumph. Parisians will see the Marseille a second time. They are en route. Frenchmen, rise up with them. Arm yourselves and march. With rebellion underway, Marseille's insurrectionists wasted no time. A departmental army had already been created days prior, and elections for a provisional municipality occurred the same day as the General Committee's provocative address. Interestingly, although there would be multiple elections during Marseille's revolt, the initiative remained with the General Committee. This is a deviation from both Caen and Lyon. In Caen, members of the department and district took leading roles in the rebellion, and for most of the revolt, decisions were made by an improvised General Assembly consisting of officials from all levels of government. In Lyon, the initiative soon passed from the insurrectionary sections to the so-called Popular Commission, a democratically elected body with delegates from across the entire department. But in Marseille, the General Committee, staffed by delegates of the sections, remained the dominant institution right up until the end. Throughout June and July, most of the actions of Marseille looked comparable to similar developments in the other Federalist strongholds. The rebels were encouraged to progress their rebellion by the overly optimistic news of the other centres of insurrection, and the rhetoric emanating from Marseille tended to encourage those centres in turn. For example, Marseille implored Lyon's authorities to put their local Jacobins on trial, something they would indeed go on to do in mid-July. Additionally, efforts to raise a departmental army were undertaken, just as we've seen in many other departments. However, Marseille had slightly better success, with its force reaching roughly 3,500 volunteers at its greatest extent. This figure was no doubt assisted by the fact that the Jacobins had previously been trying to raise a battalion of 6,000 men, and so some volunteers were ready to simply march under new orders. Interestingly, in Marseille's rebellion, we again see extensive effort to coordinate the city's response with neighbouring administrations. While we saw this with both Caen and Lyon, Marseille took it to another level, at least in terms of ambition. Inspired by proposals of Bordeaux's insurrectionists, the General Committee of Marseille met with envoys from nearby departments on the 26th of June. The result was a formal endorsement of the convening of an alternative convention near Bordeaux. This idea had already been circulating for some time, and it was the same idea that Lyon and other departments to Marseille's northeast were also considering. However, Marseille then went further, proposing that 7 secondary directorates be established to help organise regional armed forces. These centres were spread across the country and included Marseille, Lyon, Toulouse and Bordeaux in the south, Strasbourg in the east, Rennes in the west and Rouen in the north. Additional locations were specified as staging posts to marshal enlisted troops. But that wasn't all. Focusing on the south of France in particular, an area still referred to today as the Midi, discussions were had as to whether a unified centre of resistance should be created. In other words, whether multiple southern departments should band together to conduct a unified campaign against the northern Jacobins. Needless to say, all these measures reeked of federalism to their opponents in the capital. The South uniting as one, an alternative convention being summoned, the sections stylizing themselves as representing the sovereign people. From the perspective of the Jacobins, this was dividing the one and indivisible Republic. Despite Marseille's claims to be the creators of the Republic, this was nothing short of heresy. Furthermore, some within Marseille agreed. Only 18 of Marseille's 32 sections supported the measures adopted in late June, revealing an important division that we'll return to shortly. But while Marseille often followed a similar script to the other Federalist strongholds, there are two notable deviations. The first relates to successful military conquest, and the second relates to the Jacobin Constitution of 1793. If we start with the armed forces, Marseille's departmental army achieved brief but notable success. Departing Marseille on the 22nd of June, the force seized the former papal enclave of Avignon in early July. Avignon had been annexed by the French in September 1791, and the town was strategically located between Marseille and Lyon. Accordingly, Avignon's seizure was a critical step in the rebels' plan to unite the nation's south. If the road to Lyon could be secured, the armed forces of two of the nation's larger cities could be combined. Consequently, this was no small victory. In managing to seize a major urban centre, the volunteers of Marseille had bolstered both belief in and the chances of a Federalist victory. In fact, the anticipation of imminent support from the south is perhaps one factor that encouraged Lyon to ramp up its insurrection in mid-July. But while Marseille was having success to its north, trouble was brewing at home. Once again, the Jacobin Constitution of 1793 was splitting the rebel cause. This time, however, Marseille forged a rather unique response. As noted in episode 66, Lyon's municipal revolution was in part justified by popular sovereignty. Consequently, it was difficult for the insurrectionary authorities to deny the right to deliberate on the proposed constitution. In explaining its decision to convoke the primary assemblies, Lyon's popular commission characterized the constitution as a project that the French people had the right to examine. The rationale was that the examination of any constitution was an act of sovereignty, and no one had the right to restrict the exercise of that sovereignty. As such, although the constitution was a Jacobin creation, Lyon's citizens had an indispensable right to examine and adopt the proposal. But further south, Marseille had a very different view. Although the city had experienced a municipal revolution which also championed popular sovereignty, the general committee of the sections refused to play ball. In fact, aggressive measures were taken to forbid any publication from the convention, and oaths were extracted from local officials to maintain this prohibition. Thus, while Lyon's authorities thought it unjustifiable to deny the examination of the constitution, Marseille's thought it unforgivable to even put forward the suggestion. So extreme was the General Committee's position that advocates for merely the constitution's publication were formally declared traitors, and arrests and prosecutions followed. Yet, divisive measures can have divisive results, and dissent was far from silenced. While the constitution was never adopted during Marseille's revolt, the city's divisions nevertheless came to the fore. To back up a bit, even in late June, discord in the city was plainly visible. As discussed earlier, on the 26th of June, the General Committee met with delegates from nearby departments and formally endorsed a plan to summon an alternative convention. Furthermore, the meeting designated the establishment of multiple directorates across the country to marshal and manage insurrectionary forces. However, despite the General Committee being a body comprised of delegates from the sections, the sections of Marseille failed to back this response. Only 18 of the city's 32 sections formally consented to this escalation. Thus, significant divisions were already present before the National Convention commenced its political counteroffensive. That counteroffensive naturally included the Constitution of 1793, which was adopted 2 days before the aforementioned meeting of southern departments. It also included the decree demanding that administrators retract prior protestations or be labelled traitors, which was passed on the very same day that the General Committee escalated Marseille's insurrection. Consequently, within days of these decrees from the convention becoming known in the city, some in Marseille had a change of heart. As Paris had intended, these measures and other carefully crafted policies provided a potential off-ramp for those uncertain about full-blown insurrection. On the 2nd of July, the departmental administration forwarded copies of the new constitution to Marseille's General Committee, promptly reminded that they had all sworn an oath to suppress the convention's decrees. The city's insurrectionary authority dismissed the departmental officials from office. The very next day, on the 3rd of July, the officials of Marseille's local district went further. In a rather lengthy address, the district's officials retracted their previous oath and their endorsement of rebellion, reaffirming the authority and legitimacy of the National Convention. The officials called on good Republicans to rally behind the national government. Furthermore, they vocally supported the adoption of the new constitution and claimed that its acceptance was the only way to save the united and indivisible republic. In their statement, it's clear that the constitution's creation and its acceptance by many other departments had been critical in influencing this sudden change of heart. Needless to say, Marseille's General Committee was having none of it. The insurrectionary authorities immediately dissolved the district. Thus, having dissolved both the department and the district, the General Committee monopolized all power in Marseille. Internal dissent escalated as a result, and the city's insurrectionists responded through intimidation, arrests, and even trials. Historian William Scott offers a bleak assessment of the developments, accusing the General Committee of now being as tyrannical as the Committee of Public Safety, which it so abhorred. Historian Paul Hansen also addresses the General Committee's dominance and reflects on the profound implications for the rebellion's purpose and justifications. This retraction by the district officials, along with the fact that the General Committee now dismissed them from office, gained leniency for them when the representatives on mission arrived in September. But at that crucial moment in early July, it also served to change the tenor of the revolt in Marseille. By dismissing both the district and the departmental councils, and calling on the sections of Marseille to replace them, and by further taking measures to stifle dissent within sectional assemblies, the General Committee was quite blatantly asserting its own power and authority. The earlier principled declarations about the integrity of the National Convention, the unity of the Republic, the sanctity of popular sovereignty, all faded into the background. As all pretense of a national movement evaporated, and as local support began to crumble around them, the members of the General Committee grew more desperate, and, like their counterparts in Lyon, they began to look for new allies, among them whose sympathies were quite openly royalist. With substantial divisions emerging in early July, Marseille's problems soon multiplied. Although the other leading Federalist centres all remained in revolt, many departments which were meant to join the party backed down. As we saw with both Khan and Leon, throughout July, numerous authorities reversed their earlier protestations and submitted to the authority of the convention. Furthermore, by the middle of the month, the combined force of the Norman and Breton departments was defeated by the so-called Army of Pacification. Worse still, by August, Lyon had accepted the constitution and recognized the convention's authority. These measures failed to spare the nation's second city, but it did highlight the deteriorating position of the Federalist rebels. Closer to home, Marseille was experiencing its own set of setbacks. Lent credibility by the defiant actions of former officials, Jacobin sympathizers demanded both the constitution and a change of course. Unrepentant Montagnards dared to emerge, and although the General Committee adopted severe measures, the repression never silenced them completely. Unrest was the result. On the battlefield, the difficulties were even greater. Government forces, led by the painter turned military officer General Carteau, were leading a successful counterattack. This offshoot of the Army of the Alps retook Avignon in late July, and subsequently dealt Marseille's departmental army a terrible defeat on August the 11th. Help was hardly forthcoming for the defeated rebels, as Kellerman and the rest of the Army of the Alps were by now besieging Lyon to the north. Isolated, divided, and with its forces in retreat, the situation in Marseille was dire. As such, desperation turned to treason. A quick announcement from the Committee of Podcast Safety. If you're enjoying this episode and want to learn more about the madness of Marseille, then there's two amazing episode extras for this episode alone. At more than 30 minutes in length, some other shows would call that a full-length episode, but this being Grey History, well, we just call it an episode extra. So, to explore the unusual nature of Marseille's terror and the perplexing claims of Jacobin federalism, join the Grey History community today and do your part to keep the show on the air. You can cancel any time, but I need your help to keep this revolution going. Just follow the links in the show notes or on the website and help promote history that isn't black and white. Help ensure that there's more grey history waiting for you tomorrow. With defeat imminent, the insurrectionists sent envoys to the British Navy. Already operating in the Mediterranean, the British had amplified Marseille's struggles by hampering shipments of food. Officially, the delegation was to negotiate a suspension of the blockade. Unofficially, both sides knew full well that food was not the only item on the agenda. The British, under Admiral Hood, were willing to consider much more. Toulon was also in a desperate state, and the occupation of both ports would be a tremendous coup for the British. Yet, while occupation would offer protection from the advancing French government, the terms and conditions were considerable. The rebels would need to declare in favour of a restored French monarchy. Would Marseille, a city that had once prided itself on its republican and revolutionary credentials, be willing to pay such a price? That question was ultimately never answered. Marseille had only attempted to open negotiations on the 19th of August, and the British spelt out their terms on the 23rd. Republican forces retook Marseille on the 25th, abruptly ending talks just as they had begun. Furthermore, by that point in time, unrest in the city had transformed into insurrection. At least one pro-convention section formally rebelled against the authority of the General Committee. Section 11 summoned its National Guard battalion and declared itself unwilling to entreat with the enemy. Thus, it's impossible to know whether the rest of the city would have abided by any settlement with the British. Certainly, The proximity of the convention's forces encouraged Section 11 to rebel, but at least five other sections had also called for the Constitution and surrender. Thus, by the 24th of August, Marseille was divided, defenceless, and devoid of both time and options. With Republican forces just hours away, leading members of the General Committee fled the city. Having once implored the nation to fight against the capital, flight was now the only recourse left. Frantically departing for nearby Toulon, the struggle would escalate there in the days that followed. But back in Marseille, this fight had come to an end. Unity with the Republic had been rightfully restored. Yet, defeat did not guarantee peace. The list of crimes committed by Marseille was extravagant. Over the course of just 4 months, the city had toppled the local Jacobins, rebelled against the convention, implored the nation to adopt a seditious and federalist agenda, and finally collaborated with not only royalists, but even the British. If Marseille was playing treason bingo, every square had been painted with the blood of French patriots. As such, terror was now a necessity. However, for all its offences, Marseille's terror looked very different to Lyon's. There's less bloodshed, less contention, and a notable absence of mass executions by cannon. There's also allegations of Jacobin federalism, a rather perplexing accusation given the defeat of Federalist rebels at the hands of Jacobin-aligned forces. So the city's unique experience of revolutionary terror will be the focus of the rest of this episode. With government forces occupying Marseille on the 25th of August, multiple representatives on mission were tasked with reasserting the government's authority. Whereas the Committee of Public Safety had sent one of their own to Lyon on multiple occasions, no committee member was directly assigned to Marseille. Instead, a range of deputies passed through the city over the course of several months, and this resulted in a tremendous inconsistency in local administration. In the first phase of Marseille's occupation, many of the representatives on mission played a relatively moderate hand. Whereas representatives in Lyon distrusted their city's Jacobins and therefore relied on Montagnards from elsewhere in France, the deputies in Marseille were happy to re-empower and reinstate local Jacobin officials. After all, Marseille had never been a royalist bastion, but instead a city with a proud revolutionary tradition. Surely, those Jacobins who had been persecuted by the insurrectionists could be trusted with re-establishing revolutionary government. Thus, while Lyon saw the creation of tribunals and committees staffed by outsiders, Marseille's new authorities were generally entrusted to resident revolutionaries. Working cooperatively, the authorities got to work. Political prisoners were released, the citizenry was disarmed, and institutions such as the National Guard were purged of untrustworthy members. The Constitution was also promptly accepted, perhaps leading to a hope that the city's repression would be both light and temporary. Interestingly, in the first weeks of Marseille's occupation, the repression was rather limited. While a revolutionary tribunal was created the day after Marseille's surrender, the institution was hardly executing suspects left, right, and centre. Chaired by a local Jacobin who had been imprisoned by the General Committee, the tribunal slowly and methodically punished the defeated insurrectionists. This steady pace angered some, but it suited others just fine. One representative on mission was particularly keen to ensure a policy of moderation. The deputy, albeit, believed that leniency could revive Marseille's republican spirit, a spirit which had helped topple the monarchy and had once elected a Jacobin municipality. Defending his policy of clemency, Albert claimed that three-quarters of the city would disappear if all the guilty were punished. As such, amnesty for the weak and the misled was a sensible decision. For albeit vigorously repressing the revolt's ringleaders and them alone was the best path forward. Yet, while this was a departure from the Committee of Public Safety's desire for terrible examples, there were other reasons for this deviation. Moderating the situation was the danger next door. While Marseille had not been occupied by the British, Toulon had been just days after Marseille's capitulation. With Toulon only 30 miles or 50 kilometres to the southeast, the immediate danger of British, Spanish and Royalist forces deprioritised retribution. Faced with an unexpected invasion and the seizure of a strategic military port, the priority was Toulon, not terror. Eager to assist in the reclamation of Toulon was Marseille's Jacobin Society. With the local club brought back from the dead, Marseille's Montagnards did their best to help. Throwing themselves at the task of enlisting volunteers, they also assisted in the implementation of the convention's decrees, as well as the raising of levies to fund the war effort. But while the reinvigorated club at first assisted the revolutionaries on mission, it soon became a thorn in the side. As mentioned previously, Marseille's Jacobins had a history of strolling across southern France and preaching the good news. That was news not of the Christian faith, but of revolutionary ideals. With the best possible intentions, this tradition of Jacobin missionaries was also resurrected. Throughout September and October, efforts were even conducted to unite Jacobin clubs from across the south. The end result was several assemblies or congresses in which regional clubbists would gather to coordinate their revolutionary endeavours. Now, theoretically, this provided a new grassroots institution which could advocate Jacobin policies and assist the national government. But that theory didn't quite work in practice. While these meetings of Southern Jacobins were well-meaning, they quickly became problematic. If the convention adhered to the various requests of these congresses, something akin to a parallel government would fast be established. Furthermore, these parallel institutions, staffed by local Jacobins, would be quite regional and autonomous in nature. With past political societies having already claimed to be representative of the sovereign people, some considered it a matter of time before these helpful clubbists transformed themselves into a hindrance. Disgusted by anything that remotely looked like decentralization, denunciations followed. Detractors swiftly condemned these Jacobin congresses, accusing their initiatives of promoting a new type of federalism. After all, they were proposing new power to the provinces at the expense of Paris. Now, to get into the nuts and bolts of this movement's policies and these rather alarming accusations, well, that would be a reasonable digression. So, an exploration of this so-called Jacobin federalism is the focus of the first of two episode extras for this episode. Which is, of course, where I quickly remind you that I need your help to keep our little Congress going. Nothing about grey history is guaranteed. So if you want to listen to more grey history and learn more about the French Revolution and its fascinating lessons, then I need your support to keep one of your favourite independent podcasts on the air. You'll love the two exclusive episode extras for this episode alone, and that's in addition to the recent Lyon bonus episode, which will have you exploring the controversies and debates of Lyon's gruesome terror. So, for access to this great bonus content, and ad-free listening, please do your part to keep grey history going. Support the show today and enjoy all the perks in the process. There's links in the show notes and on the website. So, as you can imagine, the emergence of a united coalition of local political societies that had vocal opinions on how to best govern the country was not exactly well received by the National Convention. For those representatives on mission who had always wanted a harsher repression of Marseille, they saw this development as proof that prior policies were misguided. Clearly, toleration, moderation, and cooperation with local Jacobins was merely setting the stage for a renewed resurgence of federalism. As such, we get the second stage of Marseille's repression. While some representatives on mission had advanced a position of leniency, new management were less keen. Critically, two deputies named Paul-François Barras and Louis-Marie Stanislas Fréron were eager to amplify the severity of Marseille's terror. Now, if the name Barras rings a bell, that's likely because he's a key protagonist in the story of Napoleon Bonaparte's rise to power. Barras will go on to become a director during the Directory, and Napoleon's coup of 18 Brumaire will eventually remove Barras from office. But that's several years ahead. Regularly present in the city from mid-October, Barras and Fréron wasted no time in making their mark. Criticizing their predecessors for being soft and insufficiently diligent, the deputies would rectify excessive leniency through uncompromising severity. Tensions fast emerged between regional and national Jacobins. Like the representatives on mission stationed in Lyon, Barras and Fréron saw their provincial allies as unreliable. As such, they wished to rely on national support. With the assistance of outsiders, the deputies introduced a series of provocative and repressive measures. Denouncing the Congress of Regional Jacobin Clubs as a new species of federalism, its closure was a top priority. The problem, however, was that this and other restrictions resulted in yet more friction. As we saw in Lyon, disputes within the Jacobins could produce an awful lot of drama, and the same was true in Marseille. With local Jacobins resisting direct orders from the representatives on mission, the two sides became embroiled in bitter and personal feuds. Tensions escalated, and so too did the rhetoric. From November 1793 through to January 1794, we find a litany of accusations and complaints. It's from this period of time that we find the assertion that Marseille was the original and primordial cause of nearly all of the ills of France. In fact, Barras accused Marseille of even being responsible for the treason of Toulon. Denouncing their unpatriotic ways, Barras held nothing back. The Marseillais, by their nature, see themselves as a people apart. The geographic location, the mountains, the rivers which separate it from the rest of France, its particular language, everything fuels this federalist opinion. They would like laws for themselves. They only see Marseille. Marseille is their homeland. France is nothing. Barras's colleague Fréron shared similar sentiments. Mirroring proclamations from Lyon's representatives on mission, Fréron went as far as to claim that the rebel stronghold needed to be repopulated with reliable patriots. "I believe that Marseille can never be cured, barring a deportation of all its inhabitants and a transfusion of men from the north." Yet, this shouting match masked the fundamental issue. At stake was precisely who was to govern revolutionary Marseille. Was it the central government, through their nominated officials, or local patriots, steeped in a long tradition of regional independence and autonomy? Cooperation between the two was by no means impossible, but accommodations required compromise and flexibility. With both Barras and Fréron scornful towards the local Jacobins, politics trumped partnership. For a while, it appeared that the representatives on mission would win the day. Denouncing Marseille as seeking the restoration of federalism, the convention was alarmed to hear that citizens were resisting their colleagues in the field. Encouraged to take severe measures, throughout December and January, the deputies escalated their confrontation with the city. Critically, in early December, the representatives declared Marseille in a state of siege. Now, to be clear, Marseille was not literally being besieged. The Federalist revolt in the city had crumbled more than 2 months prior. But this declaration strengthened the position of the representatives on mission, and it facilitated greater intervention in Marseille's affairs. Now, as you can imagine, the local Jacobins were just a tad dismayed. Having spent weeks criticising the crimes, corruption, and ambition of the two-faced representatives on mission, the latter's declaration of a state of siege was a serious escalation in this intra-Jacobin feud. Thus, the city's residents responded in kind and briefly attempted to resist. In fact, the Jacobin municipality countermanded some orders from the deputies and promoted policies designed to boost its own popularity. Threatened with a military response, the officials were quickly forced to back down, and the municipality was formally dissolved in the fallout that followed. Yet all of that was just the pre-game entertainment. A month later, the deputies went further. Arresting the former officials of the Jacobin municipality, they also suppressed the Revolutionary Tribunal, which they believed was insufficiently harsh against Federalist insurgents. Leading figures of the latter were even sent to Paris for trial. In its place, a new military commission was created, and the representatives felt confident that this body would dispense justice with the appropriate speed and severity. Finally, the measures of early January also erased the name of Marseille. Like Lyon, the city's tainted title would be wiped from the map. Henceforth, it would be titled Ville sans nom, Nameless City. The convention was asked to choose a replacement. But the ascendancy of Barras and Fréron was only temporary. Marseille still had allies in the convention, including its own deputies who sat with the mountain. Dismayed by the sudden renaming of their own city, the representatives sprung into action. Demands were made to remove the deputies in the field, and by January the 23rd, the representatives were recalled. The replacement of Barras and Fréron was a gentleman named Mignet. Under Mignet's watch, the repression of Nameless City changed one final time. Far more cooperative with the local Jacobins, Mignet quickly won the support of his regional allies. Reversing the most controversial actions of his predecessors, the arrested Jacobin officials were either released or reinstated. The Revolutionary Tribunal was also re-established, as was a new Jacobin municipality. Finally, local patriots were rearmed, and the provocative renaming of Marseille was reversed. Through cooperation and skillful management, harmony was achieved. Well, at least whatever counts as harmony during the Terror. After all, the guillotine continued to fall. In total, more than 400 were sentenced to death during Marseille's repression, almost all connected to the crime of federalism. By 1794, Barère could report to the convention that calm had been restored. The same could be said for Toulon, although there the bloodshed had been far greater. Thank you for listening to episode 68, Marseille, Fight and Flight. Before you go, let me ask you a question. Did you enjoy this episode? Well, if you did, I guarantee you'll love the two fantastic episode extras for this episode. The first, titled Marseille's Terror, will have you exploring the characteristics of the city's repression. We'll unpack not only the number and social background of those killed, but also the process of the proceedings and how Marseille's experience compares to that of other Federalist cities. The second episode extra is titled Jacobin Federalism. Yes, you heard me right, Jacobin Federalism. And amongst other things, you'll hear about a blueprint used by future one-party states. There's a lot to traverse in the Federalist revolts, and these episode extras are definitely worth your time. Speaking of time, if you want to ensure that there's more Grey History waiting for you both now and in the future, please support the show by joining the Grey History community. To enjoy all the bonus content, an ad-free feed, and a range of other perks, do your part to keep Grey History on the air and support the show today. There's links in the show notes and on the website, and those on the True Revolutionary tier can already indulge in early access to episode 69, Toulon, the Flimsy Coalition and the Second Partition of Poland. Another final thank you to all members of the community, and a special shout out again to the extraordinarily generous Heroes of the Revolution, Brian, Charles, Jeff, Auger, Kevin, Scott, and Howard. Thank you for listening. Stay safe and have a great day. I interrupt this regular programming to bring you some alarming news. There's been some counter-revolutionary activity. I suppose it's a mark of the show's growing popularity, but unfortunately some reactionary fun spongers have recently left Grey History's first 1- and 2-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. Usually, I would ignore such unenlightened behaviour and consider it an inevitable achievement of all noteworthy podcasts. But, besides complaining about my shitty jokes and apparently lack of detail, yes, you heard right, these reviews are quite literally impacting the discoverability of the show for new listeners. That, of course, is jeopardising this experiment in full-time production, which I think we can all agree we don't want to jeopardise. So, if you listen to Apple Podcasts in particular, and you haven't already done so, if you could please leave a written review, that would be absolutely amazing. Just go to Grey History in the app and scroll down to the review section and help me expunge this counter-revolutionary plot. Thank you again for all your help, and now back to the show.
The Civil War and Reconstruction was a pivotal era in American history.
When a war was fought to save the Union and to free the slaves.
And when the work to rebuild the nation after that war was over turned into a struggle to guarantee liberty and justice for all Americans.
I'm Tracy.
And I'm Rich.
And we want to invite you to join us as we take an in-depth look at this pivotal era in American history.
Look for the Civil War and Reconstruction wherever you find your podcasts.